From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 19th century geologist, geographer, wilderness advocate, and mountaineer John Muir liked best to be thought of as a botanist. Wherever he walked, and he seemed to walk everywhere, from the Midwest to Florida, across California and Alaska, he collected plants. In a remarkable new book, that collection has been tracked down and photographed. It's a dazzling, sobering window on our botanical world then and now. This hour, On Point, on the trail of John Muir's botanical travels. You can join the conversation. It's spring. The season of plants is coming. Do you know what that would have looked like in your neighborhood 150 years ago? Can you picture the botany of John Muir's day? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We will hear in a few minutes from a botanist who's walked where Muir walked and specializes in the endangered plants of California. But first, joining me from Berkeley, California, is Bonnie Geisel. Since 2001, she's been curator of LeConte Memorial Lodge, the headquarters for the Sierra Club in Yosemite National Park. Muir founded the Sierra Club, had a lot to do with the creation of our national parks, Yosemite and more. Bonnie Geisel has tracked down many of John Muir's collected plant specimens and, along with photographer Stephen Joseph, has brought them out in a new book, Nature's Beloved Son, Rediscovering John Muir's Botanical Legacy. You can see quite wonderful collection of images from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Bonnie Geisel, it's wonderful to have you with us. Thanks very much for being there today.
Hi, Tom. It's wonderful to join you.
This is just an astounding story and an astounding collection of images. He walked seemingly everywhere, and everywhere he went, he took a plant press with him and did what, Bonnie?
He remembered the world around him. He thought about new plants, plants familiar to him, collecting plants that helped him to overcome a sense of loneliness as he traveled, particularly through the South in 1866. This was a way of keeping memories, of bringing friends with him and understanding science, understanding something of the beauty of the world around him, becoming more familiar, understanding the connectedness of all of life.
John Muir lived 1838 to 1914. The son of Scottish immigrants, came with him himself from Scotland to Wisconsin, grew up on a farm there. And when did he know that he was going to set out, or how did he set out, and what became the sort of environmentalist botanist passion of his life, Bonnie?
He entered the University of Wisconsin in 1861. I was studying with Ezra Carr, a horticulturalist and agricultural chemist, but he was encouraged in the area of field botany by a fellow student, Milton Griswold, who pointed out to Muir on the stone steps of North Dormitory that there was a locust tree and it was a lot like a garden pea. And Muir was very inquisitive, keen observer, delighted in the sense of the connectedness, and took to botany, bought a copy of Alphonso Wood's class book, and ran to the fields with great joy to study God's creation.
Was working in a factory in Indianapolis, maybe, got injured there, nearly blinded. Soon after, set off on a 1,000-mile walk from Indianapolis to Florida, and what, pressing and collecting plants all the way?
He, after the eye injury, decided that he would turn away from the inventions of humanity. John Muir very likely could have been another Henry Ford. Instead, he chose to focus on the world around him, and what he knew and where he was going was in relation to the study of botany and the study of plants. He traveled through the South. What he called was a strange land, and the further south he got, the more unusual it became for him. He passed mangroves and magnolia and found the palmetto in a grassy place, and there he felt that the palmetto had more to teach him than a human priest. He turned to nature as a source of truth, of divine revelation and inspiration and imagination. and was continuing to collect, carrying his plant press with him all the way to Havana, Georgia.
That inspiration.
I mean, to Havana, Cuba.
Yeah, Havana, Cuba. Yeah, further south. That inspiration clear in all of his notes. There's this great line where he's at one point he's in an Ontario swamp in Canada, and comes on this single white flower blooming on a bed of moss, and makes a note that the beauty of this one lone, I guess it was Calypso borealis, was pure enough for the throne of its creator. He was no stranger to an almost mystical enthrallment with plants, Bonnie.
I think the Calypso was what I would call an epiphany for Muir. It not only was the sense of that he was able to actually find it, but that in the plant he could see that it was not intended for him. That here's where Muir's, what I would call his moral compass, his sense of the equality of all life, the value of all life, was that in each it was first for itself and then only for others, only for humanity to see. And so in finding the orchid, he found something of this universal glory, of the fact that God as creator was a bit of a an artist, and that the beauty was in and of itself pure and by itself, and that brought him a sense of joy and a sense of opportunity.
The photographs in this book are absolutely remarkable, and listeners, if you have any way to get to the internet as we're speaking, I really encourage you to do it, onpointradio.org. These from Bonnie and Stephen Joseph's book, Nature's Beloved Son. Astonishing, beautiful photographs of the specimens that he collected. Getting hold of these specimens, tracking them down, was kind of an epic undertaking in itself. Where did they end up, and how did you track them down, Bonnie?
I'd been studying Muir and his life as a botanist for quite a while, actually. Part of my dissertation uncovered the relationship between orchids and John Muir and his mentor, Jean Carr. Their friendship continued throughout her life, and she died in 1903 when Muir was on his travels around the world. Mm. The plants were in various university herbaria and in institutions like the Missouri Botanical Garden, the American Museum of Natural History, the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. And it was a matter of rereading all of Muir's work, making lists of plants, breaking those lists down geographically, and then setting appointments and traveling to these institutions to try to locate Muir's plants. Plants are not in herbaria by the collector, they're by family, genus, and species. And so the lists were a point of departure and enabled me to try to begin to locate the plants within each one of these institutions. So it was a matter of actually going through, in some cases, a few plants piled one on top of another, and in other cases, going through hundreds to try to find John Muir's name on a particular plant specimen. When I was
amazing.
At Harvard, it
yeah.
took me about 3 days before I came upon a specimen, and those specimens were all from Alaska, collected in 1881. So sometimes it took a little bit of time in order to understand what a collection might hold.
And these plants that had been on journeys of their own, I mean, first of all in the wild, and then in John Muir's knapsack, whatever he was carrying them in, the specimens that he first pressed, and then he would be mailing them back to, I guess, family on these treks. I'm looking here at a wonderful photograph of sea oats. If I'm interpreting this correctly, were mailed in the envelope below, from the Hotel Key West in Key West, Florida, to California. And this is sometime, I guess, in the 19th century. So they would have traveled through with the U.S. mail across the country before they ever made it to the herbarium where they ended up.
This plant was sent by Muir to his wife in 1898. He retraced his steps through the South with Charles Sargent from the Arnold Arboretum at Harvard and a man named William Canby from Maryland. And he went in many of the same places that he traveled in 1867. And so this was essentially a way for him to connect, sort of like sending a postcard. Instead of a postcard, he sends a plant.
Yeah.
That's a postcard for Muir.
From John Muir,
And so these plants would go to family and friends, connecting each to the other. And oftentimes plants were also sent to Asa Gray at Harvard, to John Redfield at in Philadelphia. So he sent plants out in a variety of ways. In fact, when he was in California, when he was in Yosemite, he sent so many incense cedar plants out that it did indeed seem like postcards. He sent them to everybody to celebrate the natural world, to celebrate the way it looked, knowing that many of them would never be able to be there. And so this was his way of connecting people and his plant friends.
It was a celebration, a kind of John Muir postcard. Was it also, did he see it? It made copious notes on all this. Did he see it as a snapshot in time, as a record of the botanical world in the years of his treks? Did he hope that these would speak to botanists years down the line? Do we know?
Well, Muir collected first because he was very inquisitive. He was looking to understand something about the world. He felt beauty was a civilizing agent. And so for him, again, the idea of connecting bits and pieces, I don't think Muir would have ever even thought that I would come along someday and try to put this all together and understand the landscape that he saw. But nonetheless, for science, that was part of it. For Muir, it was beauty. It was his own inquisitiveness. He'd stick them in his pocket. He'd put them between the pages of his journal, much like people do today. So there were a couple different things going on there.
Bonnie Geisel, please stand by. We're talking about a wonderful new book, Nature's Beloved Son, Rediscovering John Muir's Botanical Legacy. We're going to come back and do a little then and now, what he saw, what we might see today. You can join the conversation at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook with a little music from that time. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Liberty Mutual, for auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual, responsibility, what's your policy? And the Museum of Science Boston, committed to promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K-12 nationwide. More information at mos.org/nctl.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the journeys and botanical collection of America's, what, maybe original environmentalist, John Muir. There's a new book out, quite wonderful, describing his journeys and with truly fabulous images of some of the specimens that he collected botanically on those journeys. It's called Nature's Beloved Son, Rediscovering John Muir's Botanical Legacy. Bonnie Geisel has brought this book to us along with photographer Stephen J. Joseph. She joins us from Berkeley, California. You can join us as well. Do you wonder how what we see in the botanical world around us has changed compared to 100 years ago and more? Can you imagine walking from Indianapolis to Florida with a plant press in your pocket, collecting all the way, and doing the same across the California Sierras into Alaska, around the world? Can you feel the excitement of Bonnie Geisel's journey hunting down Muir's collection through the herbaria of America? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. In about 60 seconds, we're going to be joined as well by a botanist who has walked some of those very trails. Let me get a call here first from Rainbow in Boston, Massachusetts. Rainbow, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to mention the poem by John Muir. He said, "Climb the mountain and get the good tidings. Nature's peace will flow into you as sunshine into trees. The wind will blow you the freshness and storms you with energy, and your worry will drop off like autumn leaves." And I use this for seminar all the time to inspire scientists. And I say scientists, when they climb the mountain, means scientists discover medicine. They knew good equipment, good idea, good funding, everything, just like climb the mountain.
It's wonderful.
Nature's peace. Nature means that nature is the best magazine in the world, nature. And if you get good data, you will publish Nature. And sunshine into tree, everybody will invite you to give seminar. And, and then you will be excited, and all your worry will drop off like autumn leaf because you will get job all over the world.
I love it, Rainbow. The wind will blow you freshness, and your worries will drop away like autumn leaves. That's great. Thank you very much for that. Funny guys there in Berkeley, I want to welcome in right now as well in Berkeley, California, Dean Taylor. He's a researcher at the Jepson Herbarium at the University of California, Berkeley, expert on endangered plants in California. He's written popular field guides on flowering plants in Yosemite and the Sierras. He's walked in John Muir's footsteps and seen some of the damage climate change is doing to plants and habitats that John Muir cataloged, also shared in some of the joy of those walks and beautiful areas. Dean Taylor, thank you very much for being with us today.
Greetings, Tom.
You may know all this like the back of your hand, but for me, looking at these absolutely marvelous specimens that Bonnie Geisel has brought back to us, I'm just amazed at the beauty, the splendor of what John Muir collected and we get to see today. And we should give us some sense of, you know, can we walk out now and collect the same kind of specimens, the same kind of health and vigor that John Muir collected in 1867 or 1901 or wherever he was? Is the natural world similar enough that we could bring this collection back today, Dean?
Well, first of all, we have to keep in mind that we're still exploring the biota of the world. We're still discovering new species. So yes, plant collecting is an exercise that botanists are still doing. In fact, in John Muir's territory, the Sierra Nevada, there is, and in California, we're still discovering on the order of 3 to 5 new species a year and have been for the last several decades. Now, the secondary question is are some of the plants that Muir found still extant or still doing well? And that's a topic that we can explore.
I hope it's more than some. I hope that a lot of them are still extant and doing well. I mean, there's so many in here. They are so gorgeous. I'm looking here at wild ginger, absolutely beautiful specimen and beautifully photographed. But I mean, when you look at a collection of images like this, Dean, do these look familiar to you from your walks and travels on the same trails? Is it all still out there, or most of it?
Well, yes. We still have the components. How long we will have them is the central question to keep in mind. Remember, Yosemite, John Muir led to the creation of Yosemite National Park, essentially, and the park protects this place that he revered. But can we protect it from external forces like global warming? Climate change is another matter.
Bonnie Geisel, you live more or less half of every year in Yosemite, if I've got it right, in your work there. When you look around, do you feel as though you're looking at, I know it's not the same Yosemite. It was in fact a town when John Muir was there, and it populated in a different way than today. But in terms of the nature that you see, the botany that you see, do you feel that you're seeing a similar world, Bonnie?
Well, the valley certainly has changed since Muir was there. When he first arrived in 1868, there were probably about 500 visitors a year. By the end of the century, there were probably about 5,000 visitors a year. Today, we have over 3 million visitors a year. The impact of people coming in automobiles, RVs, motorcycles, whatever, certainly takes its toll on both flora and fauna of the valley. And the valley changes itself. I was there last weekend. There was a minor rock slide on Half Dome. Fire, you know, natural occurring fire plays a role in the changes that Yosemite National Park and the High Sierra go through on a regular basis. So there are all kinds of things involved. The caring capacity of people, fire, climate change, as Dean mentioned, are all issues that are being discussed and consideration giving to, and what can we do to lessen our human impact and look at how climate change, the lack of water, the melting glaciers will affect all life that in Yosemite Valley.
Listeners, if you can get to a keyboard, get to the internet, by all means, check out the collection of images there from Bonnie Geisel's book, Nature's Beloved Son. Absolutely wonderful images of John Muir's collected specimens at onpointradio.org. Let's get a call from Richmond, Virginia. Lauren, you're on the air.
Hello. I am ecstatic. I'm on my way to Shenandoah National Park.
Hey,
I'm a horticulturist and master naturalist, and we're working on invasive species. I was also wondering if in her research she found any species or genus that have since become extinct or are non-native plants.
Let us look at that, Lauren, and have fun at Shenandoah. Bonnie, first to you on invasive species and their impact on the terrain that John Muir walked. Of course, it was almost everywhere in total, but maybe take California, for example.
Maybe Dean can better answer the invasive species in the
probably
Sierra.
The answer to the question would be neither, although we do know that John Muir saw plants that are now very rare. And he also, we do know, for example, that there are plants just even in Yosemite Valley, which we can no longer account for. So,
can you give us an example or two there?
Yes. Well, an example would be there was a fawn lily, or dogtooth violets, as they're called. Mm-hmm. It's a lily. Mm-hmm. In New England today or this week, the early part of spring, they will be coming up in the woods. Mm. They're a fairly common wildflower in the east, and we have species in California. There was a species of fawn lily reported from Yosemite Valley in the 1880s. Mm. There was, in fact, a specimen that was collected, and the specimen met its fate during the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. And we have not been able to relocate any members of that genus, the genus Erythronium, in Yosemite Valley in spite of searching repeated times.
Now
an example.
There are some examples which are under pressure, maybe because of climate change. In particular, you've